Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio. It is the 34th week of the year, and it has been a very busy week on domestic issues and not very heavy, I think, on international issues that we need to cover. I spoke a little bit to Keith Woods just before about the UK situation where they're letting criminals out of prison so they can jail their political dissidents. Well, first, I should welcome William to the show. So welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to join you again.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And yeah, we're going to skip over most of these international issues, but I guess you have perhaps a quick follow-up on the discussion I had with Keith Woods about the UK. I know that we've talked about it in the past few weeks, and just I guess the biggest development worth telling people about is that the UK has announced they're going to let thousands of criminals out of prison so that they can fit their political dissidents, the people who have tweeted things the government doesn't like. They're going to put them in prison and they're going to let hardened criminals out. What's your very quick opinion on that?
Well, I'm reminded of something Alexander Solzhenitsyn is reported to have said, that you're dealing with communism when the criminals are let out of the prisons and the political opponents are put in.
And that is exactly what it looks like in the UK. So we'll keep an eye on that situation. Just a terrible authoritarian situation with Keir Starmer there. And we'll hopefully touch base with some UK political dissidents in the near future on that as well. But I'm going to get straight into domestic issues now, since we've had a lot of those in the past week, and a very big development on the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, and a little bit of perhaps a fallout, a big disagreement within the coalition government. What exactly is going to happen with the Treaty of Waitangi principles? Both the National Party and New Zealand First have said at a recent meeting with the Māori King that they will not be supporting the Treaty Principles Bill past the first reading, which is what's in the coalition agreement. And I guess they've both given additional clarification around that, but interesting to hear what you think is going to happen now. And you know, the sort of the ball is in the ACT Party's court. How's David Seymour going to navigate this?
Well, what's going on is interesting. So that there's two different ways of dealing with the treaty principles. One is ACT's Treaty Principles Bill, where they want to define what the treaty principles are. And they've got a very simple and straightforward and reasonably accurate interpretation of what they mean. But New Zealand First's approach is to delete references to the treaty principles in legislation. It's interesting that both of these things are going on at the same time.
And just to be clear, I believe both of them are part of the coalition agreements as well, that both the removal of the treaty principles are something that these parties have committed to, in addition to at least, you know, supporting a treaty principles definition to select committee. And then what happens after that, nobody knows.
Presumably, if the principles are deleted along the lines of what New Zealand First is suggesting, then any sort of legislative impact they can have is minimized already. And it wouldn't really matter to as much if you were to define them along the lines ACT wanted. I find it interesting that those two things, like, it seems like you only really need to do one or the other of them, but we're doing both at the same time. And an interesting sort of dynamic that is going on here is if you look at the Māori King's coronation, which was on Monday this week, ACT were either snubbed or David Seymour chose not to go. In any case, the relations between Māori and ACT seem to be much worse than the relations between New Zealand First and Māori. And I find that interesting, given that both parties have a sort of antagonistic to the treaty principles, just in slightly different ways. If we go back a little bit more, the Waitangi Tribunal has recently released a 200-page report criticizing both ex-Treaty Principles Bill, along with New Zealand First's policy of deleting references to the treaty principles in legislation. Now, what is really interesting about that report is that it's really a 200-page logical fallacy. The role of the Waitangi Tribunal is to appraise legislation for its whether it conforms to the Treaty of Waitangi. And conforming to the Treaty of Waitangi means conforming to the treaty principles, which the Waitangi Tribunal have defined through going through these, you know, these legal procedures over and over and over. And so ACT have proposed a bill to redefine the treaty principles. And the Waitangi Tribunal is saying in 200 pages, your bill to redefine the treaty principles is not in line with the treaty principles, which of course it's not. That's the whole point. So, I mean, I just find this it's humorous, really. It's funny.
So there is the argument from Winston Peters that the treaty principles don't exist. He says it's a simple three-clause document. There are no principles in the treaty. They don't exist. I think from a technical perspective, I probably agree with him that the principles don't exist in the sense that why do you need principles for a simple three-clause document? But the other problem that we do have, I think, is that in several legal cases now, the principles have been referenced, even defined to a degree by judges, or at least judges have referred to specific principles in some judgments in the, you know, census late as I think the 1980s. So for almost the past 30 to 40 years, we've had these principles floating around in the judiciary, and the judiciary have sort of defined them when they've needed them. Nobody can actually tell you what they are, but I think if you go through some of these judgments, you can sort of pick out what some of these judges think the principles are. They don't really need to have any agreement on them. They just kind of can make them up when they make a judgment. So that creates a little bit of a problem in that even if it's not in legislation, like perhaps if you remove it from legislation completely, then it'll die off in the judiciary. But that's where I think a lot of people are worried about Winston Peters' approach, which is, okay, well, you delete all the references, but what happens when the Labour government comes back in eventually? Because everybody knows that they will. And what if they just start passing new legislation referring to the treaty principles again, and they start putting them back into legislation? What if they pass legislation that says these are the treaty principles based on what the judiciary has said, and the our principles are legitimate because the judiciary has defined them, which is different, of course, to the ACT Party's approach of saying that the people should define them in a referendum. I think the advantage of doing both potentially would be that you're leaving behind a dead man's switch that, you know, you've got this legislation that defines the treaty principles, even though they have no practical implication on any legislation. But then if a future government tries to come in and, they're sort of crippled, they can no longer use the principles because they've been defined by the people via a referendum, and it's very difficult to tweak that. That's sort of my take on what the ACT Party and what Hobson's Pledge are trying to achieve, effectively defining these principles so they can cripple any future left-wing government from attempting to use them.
Well, that's a good argument. I think you've explained that well, and I think you've persuaded me that that's a good idea. So what's happened with these treaty principles and the way they've sort of slowly emerged out of judicial decisions over a period of time, I'm reminded of the way a right to abortion was found in the US Constitution and some of these other decisions like that, where that, you know, very creative legal minds over a period of time created precedents, which built upon precedents, or built upon precedents to really create a body of decisions that made the law go where they wanted it to go, rather than based on any real reading of what the people who wrote the law were intending it to say or what it really did say. And I think that the treaty principles are really moving in that direction too. If you read the treaty itself, it's reasonably clear that Maori were ceding sovereignty to the Crown. And the treaty principles have just over time read in this principle of partnership, and that sovereignty wasn't fully ceded, and that there's this partnership.
A lot of that comes
between
out.
The two groups, and I just don't think it's genuine. I think it's basically bullshit.
That's a nice way to put it. I was actually speaking with Keith Woods about this earlier. We were talking about bad faith arguments, and this feels like one of them. Like, they've decided, our opponents on this issue have already decided what the outcome they want is, which is the dismantling of Western civilization, Anglo-Saxon government, sort of a anti-white agenda. Like, they've decided that's the end game, is to effectively delegitimize the common law and the parliamentary sovereignty, the English traditions. They've already decided they want to dismantle them. And so now it's purely a case of finding wedge issues, playing word games, coming up with silly arguments. And as you've mentioned, the Waitangi Tribunal using logical fallacies and circular reasoning just to try and work themselves to that end. Because sovereignty is best defined in terms of its practical application. And I think I've referred to the German jurist Carl Schmitt before, who basically defined sort of sovereignty as sovereign is he who determines the state of exception. So the sovereign is the one who can make the laws, who could override the laws. That person or that group is sovereign and has sovereignty. And so when you look at, say, the New Zealand government, which has the ability to govern, tied up in that is sovereignty, right? The ability to make law and to enforce law and to use power against people who break the laws that you've made. That's what sovereignty is. That's what it looks like. And so arguing over semantics, like saying, well, in the English, the word sovereignty was used, and in the Maori, the word governorship was used. These things are in practice very much tied up with one another. But if you have an ability to govern something, you have sovereignty over that thing. And the rest of it is just word games. That's all it really is. And even, you know, because we can argue historically and say, well, in 1840, the day after the treaty was signed, did Hobson have sovereignty over all of New Zealand? And it's like, well, obviously he didn't, in the sense that he couldn't actually exercise his power over the entire country. Like, that took decades to build up that government power. But then you say, well, did Maori even have sovereignty in a real sense? Did they have the ability to project their power over the country and enforce laws and so on? One of the things I was reading in a book very recently on that period in the 1830s, you had ships that would take Maori war parties from, say, the North Island to the South Island, and they would then go and raid other tribes and take prisoners, and then they would ship them back. And so you had humanitarians and missionaries in English who said those captains of those ships, they're guilty of murder, right? They've engaged in, you know, acts of war. And that went to court in Australia at the time. And basically the decision, you know, the captain was like, well, I'm just engaging in financial transaction. You know, it's just business. And I'm not breaking any laws. And of course the court had to say, well, yeah, there are no actual laws against what you're doing in New Zealand, right? Because who's to say that one tribe is can make laws over any other tribe? Or, you know, who really is the sovereign over New Zealand? And ultimately nobody is, because you can't make laws based on different warring tribes who don't recognize each other's authority at all. So that alone, as a historical example, proves the fact that, like, sovereignty is when you can actually enforce the law over particular land. That's how it should be recognized. And I think the definition of, like, what sovereignty is and what it looks like has completely disappeared and just turned into semantics and word games.
Yeah, I mean, I think I basically agree. I mean, there's a lot of historical revisionism that goes on. Maori were, you know, prior to British arrival and the Treaty of Waitangi and the establishment of the New Zealand government, warring tribes. There was no unified Maoridom governed by, you know, some sort of a unified idea of tikanga, where they were all behaving in a law-like way. And that's sort of historical revisionism. And then people have tried to say, well, that was the way it was, and then they engaged with the British, and that now we have this partnership situation. It's all revisionism. That discussion of sovereignty, that was interesting. I think concepts of legitimacy and what ought to be rather than what actually is do have some relevance, even in a totally pragmatic and realist understanding of the way power works, because people care about what's right and what's fair and what's legitimate. And when things that are perceived as unfair or an illegitimate are being done, it's more likely to agitate and inflame the passions of large numbers of people in the population, some of whom may have power and the ability to bring power to bear on decision makers, some of whom may be decision makers themselves, who will go into bat against what's being done. So, legitimacy and perceptions of legitimacy matter even in a really pragmatic, realist, cold, amoral, calculating way of thinking.
Oh, sure. I mean, from that as an example, this week, Christopher Luxon was asked in Parliament whether or not the Maori ceded sovereignty in the Treaty of Waitangi. And his response was, Parliament is sovereign. Of course, the Prime Minister can't say, you're right. I'm not legitimate, basically. That's what he's being asked or being accused of saying, well, the government is illegitimate. That's what a lot of these things come down to. And then they get mad. Oh, how dare the Prime Minister say that the Parliament is the sovereign, that Maori ceded sovereignty. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether it was ceded or taken from them. The point is that, of course, Parliament is sovereign, and that would kind of be a good place to start. But that's really where the attacks are going, in that direction of legitimacy that you mentioned, right? They're trying to delegitimize Parliament, trying to delegitimize New Zealand law, comes back through the Anglo-Saxon tradition. They want to delegitimize all of that. That's the goal.
Yeah, I think you're right. And they have succeeded now in bringing this position, which is an extreme and outsider position, and marching it into the mainstream as if this is the mainstream view. And that's how it's portrayed by a lot of the mainstream media. And it was in Labour Party policy. They were enacting it. What the treaty was this partnership agreement between two different groups. And, I'm a little bit sympathetic to Maori desire to have their unique culture honoured and have some degree of autonomy so they can preserve it and keep it going. But what keeps happening is the desire for that, which I think is a legitimate desire, which we should try and grant, keeps getting sort of transmuted into these really impractical and damaging and harmful measures that political parties and individuals keep trying to implement and sometimes do implement, like the Labour Party. It is good, in my view, to try and honour Maori culture and allow them this degree of autonomy, but we have to find ways of doing it which are pragmatic, which don't, undermine the nation, and which are fair to everyone else as well, fair to other, to non-Maori. And that's not always easy, but I think we've gone too far in one direction and lost touch with what's pragmatic.
We've both spoken to this before, I think, sort of, it would be interesting to actually have them engage with, say, us on the right wing and make a reasonable offer. And I think a lot of the problem is they're currently tied to this historical revisionism, basically. And that's not going to work. Historical revisionism is not going to be the good foundation of trying to develop some kind of autonomous form of Maori power, or where they have perhaps, more control over their own affairs, if that's what they really want, some more control over their own affairs. A large part of that may actually just involve saying, look, we lost this because of the treaty, because of what happened in history. We lost this stuff, but we'd like to have some of it back. And that would be a good, honest platform of negotiation. Say, okay, maybe we can, talk about devolved powers, and we can talk about, potentially giving you some more power over your own things. So we can talk about localism, we can talk about decentralization, we can talk about all of these good things. But trying to overthrow the government is probably not like trying to delegitimize the government. That's not a good starting. That's not a foundation that we can agree on. Right? We could agree on a foundation of decentralization. We could agree on that. We could start there. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the case. And we get this bizarre kind of crazy form of communism, whatever it can be. It just feels wrong to call it communism. It's somehow so much worse than any, whatever any reasonable communist may have come up with 50 years ago. I have no idea how to describe what's currently going on. And actually, I may just pivot that directly into a bit of almost breaking news. I think we're the first to discuss it here on the Weekly Roundup. A listener sent this in, and I was alerted to this via a post by the Auckland University of Technology Dean of Law, Kylie Quince, and she is will be well known to anyone who's familiar with the AUT Law School. And she was very happy to announce just this week that there is a new course for anyone studying law at AUT. So all lawyers will have to do this course in the first year, and it's called Tikanga Māori and the Settler State Legal System. So that's how the law school at AUT is now describing New Zealand's system, the Settler State Legal System. And I'm going to read out to you the course outline here. Again, I reiterate, anyone studying law at Auckland University of Technology Law School is going to be doing this course. And it is an introduction to Tikanga Māori and its interface with the imposed settler state legal system of Aotearoa New Zealand. So clear, just to clear that up, New Zealand is being described as an imposed settler state legal system. And these students are going to learn fundamental concepts of Tikanga Māori and the legal and constitutional significance of Te Tiriti and so on. And they're going to examine Māori as the first law of Aotearoa New Zealand and the settler state recognition of Tikanga Māori concepts. And they are also going to identify different processes for making laws. And part of the outcomes here, the final one, I think is the most important. They're going to identify processes for making laws in bidural, bicultural legal system of Aotearoa New Zealand. And they're going to examine ways in which Tikanga Māori interacts with this settler state imposed legal system of New Zealand. So that is a course at the University, the Auckland University of Technology. And it officially teaches new lawyers that New Zealand has a bidural legal system. That means two laws, for those of you, you know, less familiar with your classical languages. So according to the law school, we have two laws in New Zealand. Now, what do you think of that, William?
Well, it's just not true. This is just another example of what we were talking about before, where some of these legitimate aims of Māori to have their culture honoured and to protect it and preserve it and to live it out are sort of being weaponized to white ant and undermine New Zealand. And it's a similar pattern that we see in a lot of Western countries where the claims of Indigenous people and other ethnic minorities that have now immigrated into the country are sort of being weaponized against the white majority to undermine the nation, the historic nation. It's a damaging pattern. And it's needlessly divisive. I mean, because it's going to, I mean, it undermines things in two directions. It undermines both the, you know, the common basis for a common sharing of a nation state with Māori, and it undermines the sympathy of non-Māori for Māori legitimate claims for us to respect their culture and their desire for autonomy, a degree of autonomy to preserve it. There's nothing wrong with people studying and learning about tikanga, but it shouldn't be taught in a legal course. It shouldn't be taught alongside learning about the law. It shouldn't be put on that sort of equivalent basis. It's a similar sort of argument that we see in a lot of other areas, like they're trying to put with Mataranga Māori, for example, where they're teaching that. They're trying to sneak all this stuff in to existing courses in a way to sort of challenge and undermine them. I mean, it's sad. We need to push back on that. I think it's going to hurt both Māori and non-Māori. It's bad for everyone that this stuff is happening.
And this post here by Kylie Quince, the Dean of Law at AUT, highlights that this is basically the New Zealand Law Society has made these requirements that you know, this is top-down. The universities are being told that they have to teach these things in this way. And you're getting framing, like referring to New Zealand legal system as a settler state, an imposed settler state legal system being imposed on us. That's coming from the top down. This is something that's well within the control of the government as well. And this should be incredibly concerning to the coalition government. It should be incredibly concerning to all of the MPs as well, because I mean, this is going to potentially permanently damage the practice of law in this country, especially if every lawyer is trained in a way to be taught that there are two different forms of law in New Zealand. It's a bi-jural country, and they're taught that we have a settler state, which I think, coming from these people who talk a lot about Palestine and Israel, and you always hear that complaint of them about a settler state of Israel, essentially, again, coming back to this illegitimacy that we talked about, saying, oh, well, if it's a settler state, it's illegitimate. And so we see the same with them trying to undermine the sovereignty in this country, saying, well, it's illegitimate, right? The government is illegitimate. Our legal system is illegitimate. It's effectively a revolution. There's no other way to describe it, right? It's a very openly a revolution that's in progress. And it doesn't seem like the government has a grip on what's going on, because this to me is very, very concerning to have lawyers being taught things that are blatantly not true. And they're required to complete courses and basically affirm these things when, you know, it's all bogus. The foundation of it is nonsensical, and it's been invented in the last few decades as a way to reject our past.
Yeah, it's the sort of woke mind virus. But this is a microcosm of what's happening across a number of different areas. It's happening in a number of areas within the education system. Children are being taught this sort of two sides of things in school, in many academic disciplines. It's being filtered down through professional associations. Because it's happening all at once from many different angles, it seems as if it's coordinated, which, I mean, it seems that's a conspiracy, isn't it? Like, it's conspiratorial thinking, but it definitely seems as if that's what's happening. And it's a threat to the existing social fabric and the foundation of the nation state. And efforts should be made to figure out who is doing that and why, and what can be done to counter it.
Now, before we move on from academia, there was a report released this week as well by the New Zealand Initiative on academic freedom. And perhaps you'd like to talk us through some of those points that they've raised and how they connect with what's going on in academia.
Yeah, so a new report from the New Zealand Initiative. So there have been several studies and things done in recent years that have outlined the problems with academic freedom. So this is both students and professors feeling pressured to that if they are to bring up, if they're to speak out on some of these controversial subjects, like the Treaty of Waitangi, for example, and issues of sex and gender, the two main things mentioned in the report, that they fear losing their jobs, being passed over for promotion, being otherwise excluded or held back, or even being fired. And so that's having a chilling effect on the types of discussions that can be had and the types of opinions that can be expressed within universities. And so, I mean, there's been several studies done. The report collates these studies. It says, you know, fairly large proportions of academics feel this way, anywhere from 20 to 55%, very roughly, according to several studies, and similar percentages of students as well. And the report, so after defining those, the sort of the what the problem is, the report says, well, what's causing that? And it gets into three basic causes. One is progressive radicalism. They identify. The second is pressure or infiltration from the Chinese Communist Party. And then the third, I'm going to struggle to remember it off the top of my head. What was the third? You have to come back to me on that one.
All right. Well, we will move on to the latest polls from this week and some interesting stuff in those polls that effectively the government is holding on to its support. And I looked at the exact numbers, and basically the National Party, the ACT Party, and New Zealand First are all polling at the exact same numbers that they got at the last election. So it's quite an interesting thing to see, you know, based on the fact that the mainstream media has attacked them full on, relentlessly, run negative stories one after the other for months on end on some of the most divisive issues that you could think of. They've gone very, very nasty on some of the members of cabinet. And yet the polling numbers of the government are holding up. The media is having no effect. And so is your view there that the coalition government, with the coalition agreement, that the plan that they've put together really is working, even if we, you know, we've just identified some big problems that they need to solve, but on the whole, they seem to be doing very well as far as the public opinion is concerned.
Yes. And like you say, what's really important here is the government has rolled back, or is in the process of rolling back, or, and has successfully rolled back several of these policies or measures that were implemented by the Labor government, particularly around race relations. So the Maori Wards Bill has gone through, enabling a referenda again on the existence, or requiring referenda on the existence of some of these Maori wards. They're going to look at changing the foreshore and seabed thing that allowed Maori to apply for customary rights, customary ownership to large amounts of the foreshore and seabed. We've got the Treaty Principles Bill going on. We've got New Zealand First's elimination of mentions of treaty principles and legislation going on. And there are several other areas, and this has been met with large amounts of protests, several large organised protests by Maori and the Maori Party, and negative coverage in the media. And what it shows, I think, the fact that National Act and New Zealand First numbers have held up in the face of that, is that the government actually has a degree of anti-fragility when it comes to these racially divisive issues. I don't think it is actually a bad thing or a negative thing or something they need to shy away from. I think they could lean into it and be more popular, because I think that these policies that Labor implemented are actually unpopular with a majority of the New Zealand population. People are likely to be more positive towards the government the more of this rolling back of them that it does. So that's my take on why the polling numbers are standing up, because they're doing this stuff, not in spite of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking, is that you've got a lot of people who are sort of sitting back and watching, kind of not really confident that the government is going to deliver. That's sort of what it feels like. Like, the people aren't worried about the negative press. They're worried about, is the government actually going to deliver before I kind of really commit to supporting them? And so, like you say, the government just needs to lean into it more. And this is maybe even why you're seeing some of the tensions that we talked about before with the principles of the treaty, disagreements within the coalition, because as they head into the next election, they're also thinking about, oh, what can I leverage? And I could have touched on this earlier, but I think the ACT Party and David Seymour are really thinking that's just something they can leverage, that National and New Zealand First don't want to go and be as tough as they are on these issues, and they can pick up more support if they're shut down by their coalition partners. So, like I said, leaning into it seems to be the way to go for them. There was an interesting side poll that was done on racial tensions, and it was reported, of course, in a very negative way, saying that only 10% of the country thinks the government is reducing racial tensions, but 50% don't care, and 33% say that the government's making it worse. Of course, what the media didn't mention is that this poll was identical to one that they ran about a year ago under the previous Labour government. I mean, that's interesting in its own right, perhaps, and perhaps provide some backing for what I was just saying before. So people are kind of waiting, like, is the government actually going to do stuff before the needle moves on that? Perhaps you have some other thoughts as well on what the media considers to be racial tensions and race relations and so on, how that works in terms of how people view it. Because it's interesting that those numbers just haven't changed with radically different governments as well.
Well, if I had been polled, I would have ticked that racial tensions were high as a result of it as well. But I still support them doing it. I think any time you try and roll back entrenched privileges and people are protesting, it's just an observation. It's just a matter of fact that when there's protests going on, that tensions have in fact been raised. But that doesn't mean that the thing that's happening is necessarily bad. As I said before, I mean, I think a majority of Kiwis, a good majority, actually oppose these policies that Labor put in place. And even though they benefit a minority, and that minority is willing to protest and raise tensions when those privileges get rolled back, that doesn't necessarily mean that the majority of New Zealanders disagree with what's happening. I think they agree.
And I had the chance to speak with Cabinet Minister Casey Costello last week as well, and she made a similar comment to what you're saying here, is that she's saying as she's going around the country, she's dealing with different groups of people. They're actually all pretty happy with the government actually trying to make life better for people, especially economically, and that people from both sides are not really complaining, like the normal, ordinary people don't see any of this as a bad thing. So she, you know, because people obviously are worried, well, you know, are you actually going to raise racial tensions? Is there going to be like a violence on the streets because of protesters against what you're doing? And her response was very much like, no, she didn't see this as a problem at all. And as far as she could tell with the people that she was dealing with, they're all very, very happy with the way things are going economically and in terms of opportunity for all New Zealanders to succeed. And I think that's quite likely. I think you're not going to see any kind of descent into chaos from what the government's proposing. I think there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of noise, but there's nothing worth following through on. Because as we've discussed, it doesn't have a real foundation. Like it's all based on revisionism from the last few decades.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just as your politics gets more professionalized, you get more sort of activist groups involved in it, you get more money coming into it, you start to get a disconnect between, you know, the protests and what's portrayed in the media and what the activists are saying and the conversations that are happening between the lobby groups and the politicians and the things that actual real people really care about. You start to get this two-track sort of system. And this is really a big theme of the Trump presidency in 2016, and maybe to a lesser extent now, is that there's these forgotten men and women who they're not plugged into the whole the lobbying system. They've got no representatives in Washington, no way of bringing power to bear. So that there's a lot of issues and a lot of things they care about, but they're never being represented. And I think the more your politics gets sort of professionalized, as I say, the more that sort of dynamic that we've seen in the States will start to apply in New Zealand and elsewhere as well. And I think we're seeing that a little bit now.
We saw a very interesting pivot from Chris Hipkins on this, the Labour Party leader, where he said that this government doesn't hasn't yet seen a redneck that it won't scratch, something along those lines. I'm not sure if I'm quoting him correctly, but basically making very derogatory remark, or you could say a racial remark about rednecks, about the white working class, as that's usually considered to be a very negative, offensive way to refer to them as. I mean, what is this from Christopher Hipkins? Has he lost the plot a little bit? Has he got too many activists in his ears?
Well, I thought he was talking about me.
Yeah.
No, well, I think what this illustrates is just there's a double standard. You know, I'm not really offended if someone calls me a redneck.
No, neither am I.
I am offended that you can say, you can call white people rednecks or white rural people rednecks, but you can't use a lot of the derogatory terms that you can use for different racial groups, different, you know, sexual groups or gender groups. There's lots of derogatory words you can use for those groups too. And if you do use them, you can lose your job, you can be demonized, you can be kicked off social media, all these things. So it's the double standard that I really object to.
And that's right. He'd be on the front page of the media for weeks if he'd said it about any other group except for rural white people. Yeah.
This is the leader of the opposition, and he thinks it's okay to use derogatory comments about the white racial group, but it's not about any other group. So it's just an illustration of the double standard that still exists in our society. I think it's not good to go around insulting people, but I don't think it's a big deal, and we ought to be fairly liberal about that and not kick people out of their jobs or anything if they get a wee bit upset and use a naughty word.
Oh, well, now we're really getting controversial, William. But absolutely, I agree with you on that. Unfortunately, doesn't seem to be likely to change anytime soon. But yeah, people should relax a little bit and have a bit more fun. Back to the polling, one more thing I want to mention there. Christopher Luxon's popularity. He's up a little bit in the numbers, but he's very, very low for a prime minister. Do you think it's going to be a problem for the coalition or for the National Party? The fact that Luxon's not particularly popular, or he's not particularly high in the preferred prime minister rankings, or is it kind of actually turning into be a bit of an asset for him, the fact that people just don't care about him?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I would have thought in general it's better to be more popular than not popular. I think that's probably still a pretty good rule. But, I mean, what can I say intelligent about this subject? I mean, I think people really care, and especially in New Zealand. America has a presidential system a bit more, but in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern was very popular and very prominent. People, I think, are maybe a wee bit sick of that. They're interested in a government that gets results a bit more, and if it's a bit less about personalities, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, maybe I'm thinking part of his lack of popularity comes from people like us and a lot of the people we interact with who maybe are generally supportive of the government or sometimes, maybe apprehensively so, or at least want the government to do well, but would not describe Luxon as our preferred prime minister. So maybe there's just a lot of those people as well who, like, as you say,
Yeah.
what
Well,
might
I mean, the smart tactical thing for Luxon to do is he's got two coalition partners. He's got ACT, obviously, to his right, at least on economic issues and, many social issues. And then he's got New Zealand First as well. And those two parties are more controversial. The smart move tactically is for him to compete with Labour for the more moderate ground and leave those two for competing for the in X case, the more right-wing vote, and for New Zealand First case, I guess the more sort of, whatever you want to call it, centrist, conservative, nationalist vote. And so I think that the tactics of the situation or the strategy of the situation means that all the incentives for Luxon politically are to compete to win more vote on the left, which perhaps alienates his right-wing support and makes him less popular. But that doesn't mean that what he's doing is wrong from a tactical, political point of view.
And one more thing on the government's actions in the past week. I think it was perhaps late last week that they announced the appointments of several new commissioners. The Human Rights Commission and the Race Relations Commissions were both had, I guess, more interesting people installed in the place of the previous Labour Party activists. And you've got, and sorry, I forget their names now. I should have had them in front of me since I was going to ask the question. But they sort of have connections with the Free Speech Union. And that seems to be something that's very much upset the left and something that perhaps is hopeful for everyone else, is sort of to be able to say that the Human Rights Commission believes in freedom of speech, but the Race Relations Commissioner doesn't think that everything is bad for, or rather, a race relations commissioner sort of believes in equality, perhaps, maybe the better way to describe it, doesn't believe that there's systemic racism. I think that was the complaint I saw from a left wing, is they were very upset that the race relations commissioner didn't believe in systemic racism. But I thought, well, that's great news for us. Like, finally, are we seeing some people put into these positions over these organizations who actually are going to make a difference for us? That's really the question to be asking. And I'm very excited. I'm almost excited, not quite excited, but I think it's a very positive development to be able to have more patronage towards the right and to be able to have right-wing people, common sense people, move away from this idea of like, oh, we just need neutral people in these positions. So actually, no, we just need like sane, normal people in these positions who are going to deliver for us, the normal people. And that's much better than having neutral people, is having normal people. And it seems to be a very positive shift from this government as well.
Well, I think it's an improvement on what's been there before. I don't think they go all the way, if you know what I mean. Like, so Dr. Stephen Rainbow, who hilariously named for the role, so he's a gay rights activist and he campaigned for gay marriage. So that's where he stands on those issues. But he does have a genuine commitment to free speech. And he also has a commitment to women being women and men not being women. So that's something. It's not everything that people like you or I might want, but it's
No,
something.
I could give you 100 complaints, but from the perspective of someone who is not with the current thing, as it's called, seems to be a positive development. And then that while the sort of the ongoing social battles, that you've got someone who's a little bit on your side.
And Dr. Melissa Darby, I think similar. I mean, I know some things about her, but not a whole lot. She had definitely had some involvement at the start of the Free Speech Union. She seems to have a commitment to free speech, which is a very good thing. Her academic background is in Maori education, largely, so which is a useful thing for a race relations commissioner, I suppose. So, yeah, I mean, I would characterize these appointments as, I would say that they are kind of neutral, moderate. Liberal appointees, liberal perhaps in a classical sense. That's the type of people that have been appointed there rather than conservative people. or
No,
something.
it's fair to say that. I didn't consider conservative people to be on the cards. Sort of, I was thinking about this from the perspective of the fact that the government is fairly liberal, even though describing them as like right wing, you may complain about the specific wording, but you have people who are put into that position who basically ideologically align with the members of the government, and particularly, say, the ACT Party, the liberal wing of the National Party. They sort of have their people in charge, and they are the government. I think that's sort of a positive development, because it means that if you can shift the government in a more conservative direction, they're already primed to appoint people who are more in agreement with them, rather than what I think you've seen from the past from the National Party, is that they try to appoint people who are genuinely neutral, quote unquote neutral, which usually means it's that someone who's going to give way to the left on every single issue. And the impression I get, at least from these appointments, is that these are not people who are just going to give way to the left on every single issue. And then that's the positive thing that I'm looking for.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right, and I think you're probably largely right about that, is my take.
Well, that is just about it. I think we've got a few more economic issues that we could quickly discuss, and I think we do have maybe a couple of minutes, so I'll give it a go. But the Commerce Commission released a report this week. Sorry, they didn't release a report this week, but they had released a report, and the government has announced as well that the 14 recommendations into the banking sector will be enacted. And the big complaint was around competition in our banking sector. We have the big four Australian banks effectively dominating the sector. They want to introduce some more competition. The overall view seems to be actually be a little bit mixed from people that I've read. You can see some people concerned about Kiwibank effectively being privatized. I've also seen some criticism from right-wing economists saying that, sort of the bashing of the Australian banks is unwarranted, in the sense that they don't actually drain any more money out of New Zealand than they have been in the past, over many, many decades. But you may have some thoughts here as well on the New Zealand banking sector, just at the end of the show here.
Oh, well, I mean, there's no reason not to bash the Australian banks if you get a chance. They are very profitable. I've seen figures that say, compared to other banks around the world, New Zealand's banks are some of the more profitable. That was actually a good thing during recent financial crises. It means that we were less susceptible to systemic banking crises and shutdowns. But in general, it means that we're being ripped off. So the Commerce Commission has said it functions like an oligopoly, and an oligopoly is like a combination of monopoly, and oli means there's several of them. So it means that there's a tacit sort of, not necessarily arrangement, but they don't compete on price. They tend not to compete with each other on price. So they're competing for market share and things, but not on price. So they maintain their margins and maintain their profit levels that way at the expense of the consumers. And so the report said we need a disruptive competitor, which if Kiwibank had a bit more money, it might be able to do. And so, I mean, the recommendations I've seen there, I hope Kiwibank isn't being in danger of privatized. That's not the read that I had on the report. I thought they were looking at things like capitalizing it through the New Zealand Superannuation, or is it the New Zealand Superannuation Fund, or some of the government funds and
I
things
believe
like that.
so, yes. It was through something that the government owns. I think people were concerned, at least I don't have a particular problem with it, but I think people were concerned about it being opened up beyond that effectively, and partly privatized through, say, New Zealand Stock Exchange or something along those lines.
Yeah, well, I would have some issues if they were going to privatize it, but injecting more capital into it so it can act as a disruptive competitor is potentially a good thing. The other things they talked about, open banking, which is interesting. Open banking could potentially improve competition between the banks quite a lot, but it raises sort of privacy issues and people's lives becoming increasingly digitized and unable to disentangle themselves from the digital system, which is another sort of problem. And then the report has also asked the Reserve Bank to, get stuck in and consider competition a bit more in their ongoing work. The government said it's going to respond to all the recommendations. Finance Minister Nicola Willis has seemed very enthusiastic about getting in and doing what the report has said. And so, I mean, I think something good could come out of this. We could have, in the end, a banking system that's a bit more competitive. They compete with each other on price a bit more, and hopefully Kiwis get a better deal out of their banks as a result.
And then one final issue, perhaps not much to say, but listeners may be happy or sad to know that the house prices are continuing to drop. This is something the housing minister, Christopher Bishop, has actually wanted. He said he wanted the house prices to go down. And we saw an 8% drop in Auckland, a little bit less throughout the rest of the country. But it does mean the median house price in Auckland is now below $1 million for the first time in about 3 years. You think about how much it's gone, you know, how much these prices have gone up since then. I think we're at about the levels that the prices were in 2021. So not below extraordinarily expensive levels, but you know, certainly the people who are hoping to see an end to the drop in house prices are out of luck. I think people who want the house prices to continue to drop should be happy with these continuing developments in that area.
Yeah, I think this is a positive thing. It's good for house prices to drop. We've discussed before, I mean, that housing affordability and house prices are the single most important economic barrier to family formation and having children. So if you can get that thing right, you can start to address and help people get married more. You can help them have more children. You can start to address birth rates in that way. People who get married and have children tend to be conservative as well. So you tend to get more conservative voters that way as well. I would note that the house prices falling is happening coinciding with the immigration rates starting to fall as well. And that's no surprise because that's the demand side of the supply and demand equation. So that's to be expected. And that is an interesting policy lever that governments have to pull, that they haven't really heard them talking about that too much in the past. It's something they should be considering a bit more.
I was just thinking the same thing, and I was going to add it if you didn't say it, but I should have known that you would make that connection. But that seems to be pretty obvious as well, that as long as the immigration numbers continue to drop, likely we'll see house prices continue to drop, because the rate of building has been increased quite a bit in years as well. That can also cause other economic problems, though, like the building sector, for instance, would have been ramped up to deal with high levels of immigration. And then when those disappear, then that's not so good for the tradies, because suddenly all of that fake demand that was created for more houses has disappeared. But on the whole, I think we're on a good track here. And so it's a very positive thing. Like you mentioned, it's necessary for a country to have higher home ownership, higher rates of family formation. It has to happen, and these prices do need to come down, and definitely something that we should be glad will continue. All right, well, that is it for this week. I see I've just gone over time a little bit more than I was expecting, but we'll come back after this break and wrap the show up. Thank you very much, William, for joining me today. It was a pleasure, and we'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.